Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend podcast for the weekend of June 5th, 2015. The concept of community used to have a pretty simple ideal. You know, come be my neighbor. Mr. Rogers' neighborhood was probably the first community I joined, or at least was aware of. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. This week, our economic communities, big and small, from trade between nations to finding an online group that speaks to your inner self. So many of you from our listening community wrote us about the communities that enrich your lives, being Freemasons, rowers, artists, teachers, parents, community board members, even someone who stuck it out in an Antarctic winter with 145 other people. That is a seriously hardy community. We love incorporating our listening community into the show, so you can write us by visiting marketplaceweekend.org and clicking on Go, tweet us at MarketplaceWKND, or talk to us on Marketplace's Facebook page.
Won't you please, won't you please, please won't you be my neighbor?
We're going to start the show with a look at a very broad economic community. All of us. Americans. And the international community, as we buy and sell stuff around the world. This week, my colleague Kai Rizdal spoke with President Obama, who is in the middle of a big push to pass a free trade agreement. We wanted to dig into that a little bit more. So, welcome, Kai. It is always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Great to be on, Lizzie. Thanks.
We're talking about communities this week, and I guess, you know, you got to go to the White House, talk to the American community leader, if you will, President Obama, about international community, the trade community. He made some news in this big trade push on getting China involved. Tell me about it.
He did. Well, so the first thing I asked him was why he was pushing free trade now, a couple of years left in his presidency. And he answered that. And as part of it, he said, you know, there's this country out there, China, which is growing, great gravitational pull, and we have to be aware of that. And so I asked him about China in the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and whether or not he thought they would actually follow our lead. And here's what he said, and this is the news.
The fact is that if we have 11 of the leading economies in the Asia-Pacific region who have agreed to enforceable labor standards, enforceable environmental standards, strong IP protections, non-discrimination against foreign firms that are operating, access to those markets, reduced tariffs, then China is going to have to at least take those international norms into account.
Now, those are all kind of big academic words, but they have a real impact on everyday people's lives because what the Chinese economy does matters a whole lot to you and me.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've all heard the statistic, right? Some huge percentage of everything that's on the shelves at Walmart comes from China. So this deal matters in a real and substantive way to everyday Americans. The thing the president is trying to push here is that he wants us to be able to be a voice in the Pacific region economically, much as we have been strategically and political militarily for the past 50 to 75 years. And that's what he's trying to do here. You know, whether or not it works, whether or not he's able to build that part of his trade legacy, frankly, rests now with the House of Representatives and the vote that's coming up.
You also asked him, I think, the question that you have focused on, I've focused on, most people have focused on for the past several years, which is how does the average American feel now in the middle?
Right, right. So
is that a satisfying answer?
Well, you know, he said what you thought he was going to say, and we'll play the clip here in a minute. But the setup basically was, listen, Mr. President, next fall there's an election. A lot of the stuff in this trade package plays right into election stuff. It plays into inequality, opportunity, the income gap, all of that stuff. How does he think the average American feels now about their own economy? The person making median income $53,000 a year, here's what he said.
I think they feel better than they did when I came into office. I think they feel somewhat more stable, but they are still traumatized by seeing their home values drop as fast as they did, by seeing their 401ks shrink, even though they've now more than recovered their value if they left those 401ks untouched. So they still have those memories of instability, and that's made them cautious.
I ran your exchange past our online community, and, you know, it resonated with a lot of people. They said, kind of,
yeah,
But.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And the thing that the president sort of ignores here is just how hard it's been, how scared people were. I mean, he gives a nod to it, but I don't think he understands that outside the major cities in this country, there's still higher unemployment than there ought to be. There are still home prices that haven't quite bounced back. There are still people worried about their mortgages and car payments and their kids in school and whether or not their kids are going to be better off. And in terms of that bit of community that he's trying to build, I'm not sure he absolutely gets it.
So a slightly more philosophical question for you. The president has wrestled a little bit with this issue of American exceptionalism, who we are, who is included in our community. You and I have both interviewed him over the years. You more recently, I want to know, who are we, do you think, now?
Let me answer that question a different way. I think President Obama is a fundamental believer in the American experiment, not American exceptionalism. He is, and we've heard that in speeches through the years. But he fundamentally believes in the American experiment, which is to say that if you work hard here, if you do more than it takes, if you have energy and initiative and a belief, then you will succeed. And when that doesn't work, the government will be able to help you. The government will be able to make sure you do not suffer for it. That is what he believes. That's the basis of his thoughts on what it is that we do here in this economy. And you hear it throughout this interview. I mean, if you play the long form, we went 16 and a half minutes, he and I, and that's a thread that it keeps coming back to, that we can do this, we have to do this, and we're going to lead as the world does this.
Kai Ryssdal, it is always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks, Liz.
This week, you probably saw the photos of Caitlyn Jenner on the cover of Vanity Fair, and she sparked a huge conversation about transgender issues. But for most people, coming out as transgender doesn't come with a magazine cover or a documentary series, and it can be a pretty tumultuous economic journey. We asked Drian Juarez to come on the show and tell us about it. She's a project manager at the Economic Empowerment Project of the LA LGBT Center.
It's an amazing time to be trans. It really is. And for me, you know, I'm 42, so I transitioned in my early 20s, and up until the point that I transitioned, I hadn't heard of transgender. I hadn't met lesbian, gay people. I grew up in East Los Angeles. So for me, the world felt very isolated. I didn't know I had a community. I felt very disempowered. I had no idea what my future was going to look like. And now, you know, kids are growing up with Caitlyn Jenner on the cover of Vanity Fair, with, you know, Amazon's Transparent, with Orange is the New Black. The narrative is changing so much. And I think kids are growing up with hope.
What does the trans community look like, and how does that sort of dictate economic well-being?
Well, you know, it's an interesting time because there's so much positive media out there of trans experiences and trans people transitioning and having family members who accept them and community that accepts them. And that's really wonderful to see. But the reality of trans people's experiences is that we're still struggling economically. We're still experiencing a lot of violence. And the images that we see of trans people out in media are very privileged images, people who are able to access a level of transition that a lot of trans people are not. And so, you know, the reality of what trans people are experiencing on day to day looks very different than what we're seeing on television. Trans people are still, you know, experiencing unemployment at twice the national average.
Tell me about what you do at work. You know, give me sort of the tangible steps of what you try to do.
So at the Transgender Economic Empowerment Project, we focus on employment services for trans people. And then we also work with employers and provide them with gender and sexual diversity in the workplace trainings. So helping them facilitate somebody's transition on the job, knowing about trans people's rights in the workplace, creating environments that are inclusive and safe for all communities, and especially trans people. The hands-on work that we do with our clients, you know, know, what I see is a lot of people who have transitioned and have lost everything because of their transition. They've lost their families, they've lost their jobs, and in the midst of all that struggle, also trying to transition. You know, the clients that I work with, unfortunately, their transition stories are not like what we see in the magazines. For them, transitioning means giving up everything.
When you think about personal finance or economics, how have things changed, or are they changing, in the workplace for the trans community?
They're definitely getting better. And especially when you look at the Fortune 500 and 100 companies, you know, those employers are really investing in diversity. They're developing transition guidelines. They're doing the right thing to include trans people. But the smaller employers are still having a difficult time with understanding trans and facilitating trans people's needs or transitional needs on the job. For them, you know, it's about reaching out to them and letting them know that this is only growing. Diversity is only growing. And so, you know, employers who see the value of that are starting to make those changes.
I'd imagine that you sometimes phrase this as a cost-benefit equation for an employer. And I guess I'm wondering, make the case for a small firm, or if I'm a boss, to say, hey, listen, this is changing and you need to embrace it.
So, you know, I think that for employers who want to stay viable in the future, you know, the community's changing, acceptance is growing, and those companies that are embracing diversity and trans people, you know, are seeing greater success. You know, people want to support those kinds of employers, those kinds of businesses. It's a smart business choice to be inclusive, to diversify, and to also promote that, to let the greater population know that they hire trans people, that they protect trans people, that they have non-discrimination language that includes gender identity, that they have facilities that are safe for trans people, such as bathrooms or changing areas. All of those things equate to getting people who are really talented. And the happier people are at their job, the better work they're going to produce.
Jayon Juarez is the program manager at the Transgender Economic Empowerment Project at the Los Angeles LGBT Center. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Focused on communities in today's show, but before we get back to that, let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks those figures and serves them up at marketplace.org. Here's our digital producer, Tony Wagner, with this week's.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
$99.
That's the price for a one-day pass to Disneyland. And soon it could be the cheapest of a three-tiered ticketing system. Disney's reportedly experimenting with a surge pricing system that would charge more for tickets on peak weekends and holidays.
10%.
The government says that's about how much the average sticker price for a medical procedure rose from 2011 to 2013. That's way faster than inflation.
1 degree.
That's how much Walmart has agreed to raise the average temperature of some of its stores. It's one of a few concessions the company is making in response to worker protests. Some others, loosening up the dress code and shaking up the music. The New York Times says workers are tired of hearing the same Justin Bieber and Celine Dion songs over and over and over.
One community we wanted to return to is Baltimore. In May, the city had its deadliest month in 40 years, with 42 murders. I went to Baltimore earlier this week to talk to Munir Bahar, an accountant and community activist who runs programs in some of the city's low-income neighborhoods.
So we're in southwest Baltimore in a neighborhood called Picktown, not far from the M&T Bank Stadium that most people would know from out of town. And this is a very mixed community. Down the street, you got the hood, a place, again, where folks are living. Median income is less than $20,000. And then you got, you know, right behind us, you got $200,000-$300,000 homes.
And then down there you got kind of row houses.
Yeah, you got the hood.
Bahar and I went into his office to talk about his work, He has two main programs, Core Community, which works with kids, often through martial arts, and the 300 Men March. You may have seen them in the TV coverage of the unrest there. They go out into neighborhoods, talk to community members, and try to interrupt violence.
We go through communities and talk to residents about bringing down the violence and sort of toning down the violent culture that we have in Baltimore. So that's what we do on a weekly basis. The big march that we have is on an annual basis, in which we bring hundreds of men out and we have a 10-mile march on North Avenue in Baltimore City.
What's a day like out with the street team? What's a night like? What are those conversations like?
It all depends on the mood and climate of the people that we interact with. It's organic. You know, we don't necessarily go out with a cut-and-paste phrase that we say to everybody, because it depends on the mood, you know, of the person. It depends on what could be going on. Maybe something just went on, and we use that to start the dialogue. I mean, there are many conversations. We talk to young people. We talk to old people. Our one core message is that we must stop killing each other. And we use the word we instead of you to make the conversation inclusive.
You know, there have been so many conversations about Baltimore in the national media, here in the city, in other places. How much of where the city is trying to go, in your eyes or in other sort of community leaders' eyes, how much of that comes back to needing more money?
Well, here's the thing. Before you talk about money, you got to have a purpose. And right now, there's so many conversations in Baltimore as far as where Baltimore needs to go. But what I think is in conflict are the purposes. You have a few different Baltimores operating here. You have a corporate Baltimore. You have an affluent Baltimore. You have a low-income Baltimore. You have a street Baltimore. So you have all these different Baltimores, and a lot of the conversations are in isolation with each other. You know, there are very few individuals who can bring the different Baltimores together to have one conversation.
The sort of best numbers on mobility show if you are an African-American boy born in Baltimore, basically you're going to have a 20% earnings gap between your white peer, maybe born in Baltimore County. For someone like you who works in the community, how do you hear those numbers and not throw your hands in the air?
I don't pay attention to them. Like, they mean nothing to me. You know,
really?
Yeah, they don't mean anything to me, because I treat everybody like an individual, and I treat everybody from the jump as an individual who has the power and capacity to do anything in life. You know, a kid I'm working with could be the next president, could be the next World Bank leader, could be anybody, you know. And so I treat everybody at that level. I can care less what any report says. I don't care if the report was done in front of me. You know, I believe in a world that can be created, not in a picture that's created, and then we build a world to suit that.
So how do you do that then? You know, walk me through moving from June after a really violent month and a lot of unrest in the city toward instilling that kind of confidence in a small child who you work with, for example.
Well, it's going to take a massive program, you know, expanding program operations, which is what we're trying to do across the city. So it takes consistent engagement. The word I like to use is training. When you go, I went to school for accounting, and this was my only adult job that I've had leaving school. I worked for 30 days at a payroll firm, all right, paychecks. So, yeah, I'm an accountant, so I have the capacity. I understand numbers. I know how to crunch and all those things. But yet, I had to go through 2 weeks of training. Okay, they sent me to their headquarters in Syracuse, Rochester, for 2 weeks of training to be able to do the job that I was hired to do, which is to be a payroll administrator. So that is the model for all successful engagement, no matter what it is. If we want children to succeed, we have to train them to succeed. We just can't say, you know, succeed, do well in school, get good grades. And a lot of times that's all children are getting. And the schools these days, they're not really being trained. They're being educated per se, but education and training is different.
So how would you train me?
As a child?
Sure.
Well, through frequent, consistent engagement. You know, frequent being 2 or 3 times a week for a minimum of 2 years to be able to indoctrinate you with a set of values. Those values will be indoctrinated through, it could be classroom instruction. It could be physical training. We use physical training in martial arts here to instill values. It could be case studies. It could be field experiences. It could be trips, guest speakers, a lot of different ways to instill the same values consistently, frequently, you know, over a period of time.
What do you want to see happen here in a year?
The murder rate, I'm just starting simple, the murder rate significantly low. Significantly low. That's a stepping stone that'll provide the morale that the people need, the hope. Right now, the current murder rate is destroying people's hopes and sense of hope for Baltimore City. I mean, it's people operating in a state of fear versus a state of hope.
Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech. Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie. I want to play something for you. And it's a sound that you should recognize. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Hit it.
Okay.
Is that someone sucking through a straw?
This is a good guess. That is a woman brushing her hair.
Whoa!
And that's a video, actually, on YouTube. And these videos are really popular in certain communities.
Like how popular?
Like one of the most popular channels for sounds like this is called The Water Whispers. Let me play you a clip from Ilsa Blansard, the channel's host, and let her explain a little bit here before I tell you the numbers.
Okay.
The Water Whispers, Ilsa.
My channel is about ASMR, and ASMR stands for Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. Many people describe it as a relaxing, comforting feeling and a tingly sensation that you can get in your head and your entire body. There are actually a lot of people out there who experience this.
I'm getting a tingly sensation, but I don't feel relaxed.
Oh, see, it actually works on me.
It worked for you?
Yeah.
Wow. So like she said, Lizzie, like Ilsa said, ASMR is this niche that people like her have kind of plugged into. And the Water Whispers YouTube channel, for example, has 152,000 subscribers and 27 million views.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
Yes. So these vloggers, I guess we could call them video bloggers, are able to make a profit from a YouTube partnership thanks to something that's called CPM. Now, CPM stands for cost per thousand M, you know, as in mille.
Mille in French. So, all right, cost per thousand in French.
In this case, we're talking about 1,000 views of a single video, right?
How does the money work?
Well, YouTube, for instance, shares ad revenue with video makers. This is one of the reasons that people do this stuff on YouTube.
Explain to me kind of how this works.
Okay, so have you ever tried to watch a video on YouTube, Lizzie, but before it plays, you get an advertisement?
Yeah.
That's called a pre-roll ad. Sometimes you can click away from them. Sometimes you can't. And every 1,000 times a pre-roll advertisement is shown to somebody online, YouTube gets paid some amount of money and the video channel gets paid some amount of money, right? So the amount can vary, but typically YouTube is paid between 20 and 25 bucks for every 1,000 ad views. And then the user that created the video gets a cut of that.
So when we talk about these different communities online, if you are catering to ASMR like Ilse, what kind of money are we talking about?
Well, it's a little bit hard to tell. Assuming Ilse's channel earns the minimum CPM share from YouTube, depending on how you slice and dice it, her channel has maybe brought in several $100,000.
Wow.
But we should say most YouTube creators don't talk details about how much they make, and some of them are actually not allowed to talk about how much they make through YouTube.
So because we were curious about this stuff and the idea of, you know, maybe dropping this whole radio hosting thing and just making videos online, we decided to call up Ilse and ask her a couple of questions.
Yeah.
Hi, is that Ilse?
Hi.
So you are the Water Whisperer.
Yep, that's me.
How much money are you making?
With the amount of subscribers and views that I have, I wouldn't say is enough to make a living off.
So you're saying I shouldn't quit my job and just make YouTube videos?
No, for sure. No, I would not recommend anyone to do that.
So Lizzie, I talked to Bethany Moda recently.
Yeah.
She's like super
huge
famous
YouTube
on
star.
YouTube. Yeah. So she actually makes money when a company comes to her and says, hey, can you put our stuff in your video? And they work out a deal that way. Or she makes money by actually designing a clothing line and having that be available at a big box store or something like that. So it should be noted that a lot of these users, they're making some money like Ilse is. But if you really want to make a lot of money, it's kind of a 24/7 job because you actually have to cultivate the community around your videos.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to the wonderful world of tech in real life. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Lizzie.
We just heard about an online community, a group of people drawn together to enjoy the same thing, and the people who've turned that into a business. But ASMR is just the tip of the iceberg. On the internet, there's a community for basically everything. And as these communities grow, the rules about managing them are constantly changing. Karen North is the director of the USC Annenberg School's Digital Social Media Program. I asked her to run me through what's out there.
The beauty of digital social media and of the development of communities online is that now people can find like-minded people out there, even if they would never find them in the physical world. So you have everything from any political belief to people who like specific video games to health support groups, eBay power users, sports, music, drugs, weapons, books, terrorists, and even communities for people who like to chew ice.
You are trained as a psychologist. What is it about the online world or mechanism that draws people to these communities?
That is a great question. I mean, there are two things. One is that it really is true that similarities attract, and people like to find people with whom they share common beliefs and passions. And in your everyday life, you can't necessarily find people who share certain beliefs and passions. And online, you could find them. The second thing is that there's a certain anonymity online, and so you can find people to discuss and feel a camaraderie with on topics that are not as socially appropriate or socially sanctioned. So you can talk about the things that you would not talk to with your daily friends or your work friends. And finally, it's ubiquitous and available all the time, always on. So at any time of day or night, you can go participate in a conversation.
I mean, I think on the one hand, that makes sense to me. You know, I look at Tumblrs for eating disorder recovery or artists sharing their work on Instagram. Anonymity, though, also brings out the dark side of people, and we've seen that a lot online.
When people are anonymous, then the social cues that govern social behavior and civil behavior are not necessarily there, or they're not well read. And so people can violate social norms and do it in a way that can be very hurtful to each other, or that can be really maladaptive.
A lot of the big companies are wrestling with this now, this question of, you know, speech versus abuse. Twitter is kicking off some notorious trolls. Reddit now has this anti-harassment policy. How does a company that, after all, exists to make money find a balance?
The examples that you gave, those are businesses. I mean, my favorite recently was Twitter. Twitter decided to announce, or somebody leaked the memo that said we're kicking off the trolls. So they had a decision to make. They kind of wanted to be the anybody can say anything place, And at the same time, the people who were really important to that community, the people who were interacting with each other and turning it into a really engaging and wonderful user experience, some of those people were the target for some of these trolls. And they had to decide, who is their community for? And Twitter and, you know, power to them from my perspective, announced, hey, you know what? Here's our plan. We are going to be there to protect the people who play in a civil way and create an engaging civil community for everybody to share. And when we find hostile people, we're going to kick them out. So they protected their power users and they kicked out the people who made it an unpleasant experience. And that is both a good community decision and it's also a really good business decision.
Yeah, that's got to help their bottom line, I would think.
It would have to, because the trolls are not helping them to grow their community or to make any kind of, you know, revenue decisions. It's only negative. Who wants to be attacked just because they're tweeting out whatever they care about?
Isn't there an argument to be made, though, that the First Amendment protects free expression and freedom of speech and people should be able to say whatever they want?
You know, the whole freedom of speech argument, I think, is one of the most misunderstood aspects of the whole digital world. So people have a right to free speech, but that does not mean that people have the right to say anything anywhere. Just because you have the right to free speech in America does not mean that you're allowed to say whatever you want, wherever you want. And in this case, the wherever you want is on other people's platforms. So you think, well, it's Facebook or Twitter, I should be able to say whatever I want. That is not a public space. That is a privately owned business. There is no right to free speech on somebody else's platform. There is your right to free speech does not extend to somebody else's business.
Karen North directs the USC Annenberg School's Digital Social Media Program. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We've been talking about all kinds of communities on the show this week, and this next one is a little bit hidden. And were it out in public, it would definitely catch your eye. And now's the time to tell you that if you're listening with kids, we're about to talk about nudity. The nudism industry. Nude tourism is a big and growing industry. Author Mark Haskell-Smith saw, and yes, bared it all to write his new book, Naked at Lunch. He joins us to talk about the business of being naked.
There's the nudist resorts. You know, I went to one in Palm Springs, but there's 200 in the United States that are, you know, basically hotels and with swimming pools and a lot of times with lakes and park areas that are strictly nudist. A lot of pickleball courts. And then I went on a cruise, which was basically a Holland-American cruise ship that had been commandeered by nudists. There were 2,000 nudists on the cruise. And in Europe, you know, you have some cities, like I went to a town called Vera in the south of Spain, which has a very famous nude beach. And so the whole town is clothing optional. And when I interviewed the mayor there, he said that, you know, they call them naturists there, but basically the nudists were the prime economic driver for their whole area.
That's amazing. You talk about something like Holland America. I mean, that's a major company. What is in it for them, economically speaking, or for this town in Spain, to have this kind of nudist appeal?
It gets the butts in the seats, I guess, is one way to say it. I mean, basically, you know, you've got a cruise ship that is rented by a nudist cruise company. And last year, there were about 45 of these cruises and Princess Cruises and, you know, all the different lines. It's a charter. So they charter their ships and they go to the same ports they go for what we call a textile cruise, people wearing clothes. For them, it's a big business.
How much does it cost to go on one of those things?
It's about $5,000 for a week in the Caribbean.
You practice an immersive blend of journalism, shall we say. What was it like to get comfortable shopping naked, sitting by the pool reading your book naked, just doing all this stuff without clothes?
It took a while because, you know, I'm sort of I guess like anybody, I don't really go out of the house without clothes on ever. So the first couple times I did it, I was a bit petrified, and I would spend hours putting on sunblock so that my entire body became quite shiny. But as I got more used to it, and particularly when I was in this place in France called Cap d'Agde, which is a city, and there's basically 60,000 nudists in this place, and so all the grocery stores and the restaurants and, you know, there's even a dry cleaners there. Everything is conducted in the nude. So by the time I was nude grocery shopping, I just had sort of embraced the ridiculousness of the whole situation and began to enjoy it, actually.
Tell me what it was like to shop naked.
It was so weird. It was really kind of fun, I have to admit. Normally, I think people check each other out when they're at, like, grocery stores or anywhere, you know, and it's no different when everyone's nude. Only now, it's just kind of like no big deal. It's like, you know, oh, that was woman's breasts, and oh, there's that guy, okay, and here I am. And for me, ultimately, trying to speak French was way more embarrassing than being naked.
My mind sort of has this picture of nudism probably firmly rooted somewhere in the 60s, maybe in the 70s. But this is a big industry now. How big are we talking about?
The numbers are like 440 million a year. And that's cruises, resorts, and merchandise. This is according
to the... What kind of merchandise?
I know, right? T-shirts that you don't wear. I don't really know. But that's according to the American Association for Nude Recreation, which is like a trade organization.
Is this something that you see as an expanding industry, or is this growing?
It seems to be. Particularly the cruise ship part of it is really taking off. I mean, I think it started about 15 years ago, and there was maybe one or two charters, and now there's about 45 ships going out every year. So that seems to be taking off. And, you know, one of the things that they're not resorts, but there's... Particularly in Pasco County, which is just north of Tampa, Florida, there's housing developments, these entire subdivisions that are for nudists. So they're, you know, there's a whole real estate market of people who buy into these areas. So you go get your mail in the nude, you're mowing your grass in the nude, you know. So there's that, too, which might not even be in that 440 million calculation.
Someone in this book tells you that nudism is a completely anti-capitalist statement. And if everybody did it, our economy would crash. What do you think about that?
I actually kind of love that. You know, the one thing about nudists that I found fascinating, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, is because they're rebels, right? They're people who, they stand up against all the, you know, rules of church and society and even some of our laws. A lot of them risk a stigma that could cost them their jobs. And they do it just because it feels good. And that's what that guy was saying, was like, that is a completely anti-capitalist thing. You don't need to purchase anything to be happy.
And at the end of all of this, do you feel that way?
No, I still like to buy stuff. You know, I have actually a lot of sympathy and respect for people who are nudists. And I will confess, I do like to skinny dip. But would I like to stand around a barbecue in Palm Springs with 100 naked retirees? Probably not.
Mark Haskell-Smith is the author of Naked at Lunch. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Go underground to a community that makes money entertaining commuters beneath New York City. Believe it or not, there's a pretty complex system that dictates the rules of this underground economy. Marketplace's Tobin Lowe investigated and joins me now. Hey, Tobin.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we're talking about an underground economic community, literally.
Yes, but it might not be what you think.
Okay.
I want to start out by playing you a clip. So this, of course, is the didgeridoo. But it's also the sound of a musician auditioning to be part of the community of subway performers known as Music Under New York. It's a program run by the MTA that schedules performances in some of the busiest subway stops, like Times Square or Grand Central Station.
Right over near us.
Exactly. But to be part of the program, you have to audition. And this year, out of 70 groups that auditioned, only 20 to 25 will get spots.
So what does it take to make it?
Well, the musicians are judged on a lot of things. Talent, obviously. But you also have to adhere to certain rules about volume. So, for example, I love a good marching band, but not when I'm on the C train. But the judging panel is also thinking about the roster of musicians they're putting together. Like Alex Steiermark, he's been a judge for the program for about 15 years. He talked a little bit about what he looks for in the groups.
I tend to look for acts that represent sort of the musical and cultural diversity of New York, that are probably things that you might not hear otherwise. I tend to shy away from bands that you would see in a club or in a regular venue.
So in this community of subway performers, a lot of thought goes into diversity.
So only about 20 groups get in. What happens if you don't make it? Does it mean you can't play? Can't, you know, try to make some money down there?
No, and this is actually where it gets tricky. You can perform anywhere in the subway without a permit. But again, volume, it's a big deal. So if a cop thinks you're playing too loud or you have an amplifier, you risk getting a ticket or even arrested. So groups who have already been playing in the subway for years, some of them will sometimes audition for the program just so everyone's clear they've been approved to be there.
We are talking about where the economy collides with real life. Musicians are doing this, you know, to make some money. How much do they make?
Well, Alex Steiermark, the judge we heard from earlier, he said he's seen groups make as much as $1,000 in just 2 hours
Wow.
of playing in subway, right? But how much a musician takes home depends on how big their group is. And when you consider a lot of these groups are duos or solo acts, you know, that's a good amount of money to make in just a couple hours of playing. But I also think that there's bigger payoffs that a lot of these groups are thinking about. So I talked to a singer who goes by the name Lachi. She's the leader of an all-female a cappella group called Femme Rhythm. And she wasn't so focused on the money.
I think that one of the biggest things that we really want is exposure, because we would love for this to lead to just a passerby going, wow, I'm really interested in that, and then allowing that to give us bigger and better shows.
And, you know, she makes a good point. About 204,000 people pass through the Times Square subway stop on an average weekday in 2014. So let's say you play a couple hours and you get even just a piece of that traffic. That's still a pretty huge reach in terms of audience. And that number is even higher on the weekends.
You have done this in your own life. You used to play in the subway.
Yes, in a former life, I played in the subway.
Okay, you play the cello. How much did you make when you went under there?
So we had a group of five, which is a little larger for these groups and how big they tend to be. I would say in a 2 to 3 hour time slot, we would each take home $200 about.
That's not bad.
It's not bad.
Marketplace's Tobin Lowe, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Here's a question. Are you beach body ready? No, I'm not really asking. That is, in fact, the headline of an ad campaign that inspired a huge backlash in the UK. It was run by Protein World, a British company that sells weight loss products. Posters with a model and that now infamous slogan were displayed on billboards across London's underground system. And that created a community that rallied against the ad and eventually got it banned. Elizabeth Hodson, with our partners at the BBC, has this story about digital communities and advertising.
London's underground is full of adverts, and whilst many are ignored by busy commuters, one recent ad has been catching a lot of people's attention. Big, bold, and sunshine yellow. A bikini-clad model strikes a confident pose next to a photo of a weight loss product. Emblazoned across the length of the poster in heavy black font is the question, "Are you beach body ready?" Many of the posters were vandalised with messages such as, "Your body is not a commodity," as well as the more straightforward, "F off." This wasn't the only kind of protest, though. Student Charlotte Baring started an online petition to get the ads taken down.
Protein World isn't alone, but this advert is more explicit in the way it addresses itself to the general public, and it says, you know, are you Beachbody ready? When I'd been on the tube, I'd been with my mum at the time, and we both looked at each other at the same time and kind of said, can you believe that advert? I kind of gathered the idea that it wasn't just me that was offended by it, and so I decided I could see what would happen if I could rally support in one place.
The petition soon gained support on social media. Juliet Burton tweeted Protein World about why she'd signed the petition, writing, I spent life believing I'm not good enough. Protein World responded by saying, why make your insecurities our problem? And on the BBC last week, the company's head of marketing, Richard Staveley, defended the ad campaign.
You see something aspirational. You know, you're not going to see a toothpaste company advertise a mouthful of grey, wonky, broken teeth. On what level would that make sense? Now, I'm not saying that all we're doing is telling everybody that they've got to be fit and toned to go on the beach at all. It's asking our audience if they've reached their own health and fitness goals. I mean, how easily offended are these people?
But people definitely were offended, and Charlotte's petition was signed by over 70,000 people. This led to the UK's Advertising Standards Authority banning the ad and launching an investigation. But in a strange twist, could the controversy turn into a victory for Protein World? Has the publicity given a boost to the company? Nikki Unsworth is from advertising agency BJL.
There are some people who've jumped to its defence, and they probably are more the people that would be its target audience. So I suppose the best hope for the brand is that amongst its target audience, it still has traction and some level of appeal and much greater awareness than it otherwise would have had. I think, however, to the broader audience, it's not been good publicity. So, for example, it could limit their brand extension if they wanted to go into more generic health products. I don't agree the fact that any publicity is good publicity.
The Protein World ad isn't an isolated example of the power of social media. Last year, a similar online storm forced US underwear company Victoria's Secret to alter its Perfect Body ads. So is the internet army something advertisers will just have to get used to? Here's Charlotte Baring again.
Social media obviously has played a huge part in this, and I think it's a really useful tool because a lot of people who might not have seen the advert in its real form but might still disagree with it and think that this is something that needs to be addressed in our society are able to support it and share it and talk about and discuss their views on it. I hope that social media will contribute to social change.
Advertisers have always shocked and provoked, but nowadays they have to be prepared for a reaction. Sometimes from unexpected quarters, as I found out last weekend in London's Hyde Park. At Taking Back the Beach, a protest against the Protein World ad, several hundred demonstrators proudly displayed their bodies in beachwear, and I found this person shivering under the cold, grey skies.
What's your name, sir?
My name's John.
You're one of the very few men at the demonstration. You're dressed in a pair of black underpants.
I wasn't organised enough to bring my swimming trunks along.
What is it about the ads that have inspired you to come out and sit in the middle of Hyde Park in your underpants?
Anyone should be able to go down to the beach, and if you want to sit in your underpants in the park, it's great that we live in a country where you can do that. I'm not a fan of things that promote specific body images.
Advertisers may have to tread more carefully in the future as social media proves itself a powerful force for change.
Music like that from the Appalachian Mountains in some small, close-knit communities became known across the country thanks in part to Gene Ritchie, who died this week. Ritchie was the youngest of 14 kids with a family legacy of telling great stories.
False Sir John a wooing came to a lady young and fair. May Calvin was this lady's name and her father's only heir. Her father's only heir.
She moved to New York in the late 1940s, and Ritchie brought something with her, a dulcimer. And her music introduced the instrument to widespread new audiences and customers. She and her husband also had a business selling dulcimers. Gene Ritchie was 92. We're ending the show today with her song, Sweet William and Lady Margaret.
Sweet William arose one May morning and he dressed himself in blue. We want you to tell us Something about that long love between Lady Margaret and you. Well, I know nothing about Miss Lady Margaret's love, and I know that she don't love me.
Okay, that's our show for this week. Next week, we're talking about migration, and we want to know, what would it take for you to leave your current life and move for a job? Let us know by visiting marketplaceweekend.org, reach out on Marketplace's Facebook page, or tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Ravi Carmen is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.